and I will answer your questions and explain a variety of tax-savvy ways to make gifts to your favorite organizations, including some that can enhance your current income. To reserve a place, please phone Martha Brown at 217-244-8128.
Support for programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings every Saturday from 2 to 6, and beer and spirit tastings on Sundays from 3 to 5. Information at thecorkscrew.com.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, I think we know that going back some time in human history, there have been individuals, maybe physicians or philosophers, priests, even artists, doing what we would call psychology, working to solve the puzzles of human behavior and development. And certainly, we can be sure that almost as long as human beings have suffered emotional pain, there have been those who have tried to help. Psychology as a modern science is not quite that old. A German scientist, Wilhelm, gets the credit for setting up the first laboratory to study psychology. That was in Leipzig in 1879. It wasn't long before American psychologists were studying with him and then coming back home to start their own laboratories. The first was at Johns Hopkins University. That was in 1883. By 7 years later, there were 40 such laboratories. 9 years later, the American Psychological Association was founded. By 1917, it had over 300 members. It wasn't long, though, before there was a change in the nature of psychology in the United States, and World War II marked a big point of change. When we go from the point where most psychologists in America were teachers and researchers who were based at universities to a point where most of them were doing applied work, they were doing counseling, they were working with people in distress, and they, generally speaking, were people who were independent or in private practice. In this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about psychology in America in the 20th century. Now, obviously, that is a very broad subject. You could do an entire survey course. You could spend an entire year probably talking about that. We'll try to narrow things down just a little bit by concentrating primarily on clinical psychology, although we might well get into some other areas as well, and try to ask some basic questions about who were the key figures in psychology in America, what were some of their ideas, and how did that influence the field in a larger way. And we have as our guest David Baker. He is professor of psychology at the University of Akron. That's in Akron, Ohio. He's also director of the Archives of the History of American Psychology. He's been good enough to spend some time talking with us this morning. He is also, by the way, just I want to mention, if you'd like to have something that would be a survey, in a sense, of psychology in America, you might take a look at a book which he co-authored along with Ludi Benjamin. This book is titled From Seance to Science, A History of the Profession of Psychology in America. It's published by Thomson Wadsworth, and it is just one of I'm sure, a number of books on this subject, but it's a good brief kind of history, and if that's a kind of thing that you're interested in looking at, you could certainly seek out that book. Professor Baker, hello.
Hi, good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. You know, I think I started thinking about trying to do something on the subject. It was probably when I read about the passing of Albert Ellis about a month ago. And he certainly was a very influential American psychologist. And I started thinking about who might be the people, the names that would stand out in the history of psychology, particularly when we're talking about clinical counseling psychology. That and as I said, obviously, the field is very broad, and there are people who do all kinds of different things in psychology. But since this is the kind of thing that I think people think about when you say psychology, I thought maybe it would be interesting to try to do that. Now, again, even if you make that your focus, that still you could do an entire course on that, so we can only try to hit some highlights. But maybe as a very general sort of a way to start, I guess I would ask this question: can you say that Americans have made particular, special, unique contributions generally to the practice of clinical psychology?
Yeah, I certainly think so, and I think that if you look, that probably the majority of the world's literature in areas of clinical and counseling psychology probably emanate out of the United States. And it's an interesting history, and I think that your introduction was a good one, David, about the kind of rapid rise of psychology in America in the 20th century. And it is important that I think you're absolutely right that the popular perception of psychology is what they see of the psychologist's office. Shows such as the psychologist in the Sopranos was very popular, and those kinds of public portrayals. And I think that in general, that's what the public tends to think of. Although, as you mentioned in your opening, the field is very broad and very vast, and it covers certainly areas of practice, but also the science of psychology. And an interesting note: when I was invited to appear with you on your show, just the recognition that right there at the University of Illinois, you have a really tremendous program there with a very rich history that I think represents a lot of the things that we're probably going to talk about today, and that is the infinite variety of areas in psychology and their contributions to society.
I certainly think, Ed, it's worth noting the degree to which psychology, psychological concepts, the ideas of counseling and therapy have penetrated American popular culture. And certainly you make reference to seeing, for example, in movies and television, seeing therapists and people doing therapy. And I'm sure that psychologists are sometimes unhappy with what they see. I think that perhaps the only profession that gets a worse treatment in popular culture than journalists are psychologists.
Yeah.
Do you think that in fact it this kind of thinking about psychological issues penetrates American popular culture more than in other places?
You know, it'd be hard to say. I do think that there is in our culture everybody's a psychologist. And I certainly think that the field of psychology has contributed to the creation of a whole kind of generation of armchair psychologists. But it's only natural. I think it's only human nature that we question people's motivations, why they behave the way that they do. It's particularly true in relationships. We try to figure out why someone is doing or not doing something we think they should do or we want them to do. And it seems that most everyone has a psychological opinion.
Yeah. I suppose you really, although you can go back and you can certainly see instances of people doing or attempting to do what we would call therapy, people who have done psychological things that we might call psychology, psychological research, going back perhaps even to early years of America, at least certainly there was the perception that there was mental illness and that there was a need for some kind of services, if only housing, for people who have mental illness. But, you know, having said that, it seems that really we're talking about if the birth of modern American psychology is right around the turn of the last century, when we have this now rapid growth in the numbers of university centers where they were studying it, beginning with G. Stanley Hall at Johns Hopkins, and then also about that same time, in a little bit before the turn of the last century, Leitner Whitmer sets up what is apparently the first psychology clinic in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's where we really begin. Maybe we can, as a way of talking about how things progress, divide things up chronologically, in a sense, and maybe I could take chunks of time, and you could talk about it a little bit that way, and maybe it would make sense to talk about the first chunk being, say, roughly around 1900 up to about maybe World War I.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening now in the beginnings of psychology in the United States?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that you have to look at really simultaneously what were the developments in American society and culture. So you have, at the turn of the century, obviously a very large wave of immigration. You have a shift from an agrarian to a more urban society, an industrial age. And these large urban centers, places like New York, Philadelphia, and Chicago, you had an excess almost of human capital and labor. And so one way of looking at the rise of counseling and psychotherapy services would be the need for efficiency in the industrial age. So I'll give you an example. Trying to determine in factories and mass production, you know, that they relied on efficiency. The new technologies of efficiency and an emphasis on technological science. And those same kinds of procedures were soon applied to human beings to make it a more efficient human being. And a part of that was classification. So psychologists at the turn of the century were very much involved with trying to best fit persons with environments. And that's a very enduring theme in psychology, and I think an important way to think about what we do in applied psychology is trying to help maximize the adjustment between persons and environments. Mm-hmm. But in the early part of the century, this was trying to maximize the fit between kind of industry and labor. And so psychologists were very much involved in testing of aptitudes and abilities to find the right person for the right job. And this led to programs of vocational guidance as a very early form of counseling.
Yeah.
Where psychologists could apply these early and sometimes very crude measures of aptitude and ability to help people find their place in this new world order.
That's interesting that if you look at one of the many subfields of psychology, that being counseling psychology, mm-hmm. now we think of that as being like therapy, that, you know, that is working with people to help them deal with whatever problems they have and to, you know, live a hopefully a happy and successful life. But in the beginnings, counseling psychology really was more about that the other kinds of counseling, in a sense, that it was that is trying to look at people, help them to assess their strengths and weaknesses, and indeed do just what you say, and in a sense, trying to fit people with their environment. And one important environment that we're trying to fit people in was the work environment. And over time, this really, I'm sure that there are still people who do that kind of thing, but over time, the shift was much more to interpersonal relations and other facets, you know, helping people with other facets of their life.
Yeah, other forms of adjustment to other types of environments. And indeed, the division of counseling psychology they recognize today began as, you know, the division of personnel and guidance. And it also had a long history in that early part of the century of really a concern for the welfare of children. Children were dropping out of school before the sixth grade, often going to work in factories. There weren't child labor laws. There were many children who were really adrift and many very horrible stories of kind of life for the urban poor. Many people were concerned about. It was known as the child-saving movement. People very much concerned with finding ways to improve the lot of young children.
Hmm.
But okay.
Yeah. Oh no. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was going to say that you know we would. I think you noted it would take us most of the afternoon. And but the jump to, and you've made reference a number of times. We talk about Albert Ellis, and we talk about the modern conception of what psychologists do. That again is rooted in a set of contextual factors, and that being the impact of World War II on American psychology, which was enormous, and we could spend a great deal of time talking about. But in terms of what we know today of clinical and counseling psychology and of psychotherapy services, a sea change was brought about in American psychology and society with the advent of World War II. And very briefly, during World War II, the psychologists had used many of their tools and techniques quite successfully during the First World War, and really helped give psychology a place because it showed its utility in classification and selection of recruits and other things. By the time World War II came around, the federal government understood that the majority of casualties from war were psychiatric casualties. And they also knew, when they looked at the numbers, that there was not nearly a sufficient supply of mental health professionals to meet the current and the expected needs for psychiatric services. And the government mobilized very, very quickly with the United States Public Health Service, the Veterans Administration, the American Psychological Association, to form to form doctoral training programs in psychology. And it wasn't just in psychology. There was extensive support for psychiatry, nursing, social work, and psychology to very rapidly mobilize a force of mental health professionals. And I can't stress enough how the impact of those events. The National Mental Health Act was passed, which created the National Institute of Mental Health, and it poured just very large sums of money into the creation of a mental health force in America.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with David Baker. He is director of the Archives of the History of American Psychology. He's also professor of psychology at the University of Akron. And we're talking a bit about psychology in America in the 20th century. And questions are certainly welcome. We have someone here who is ready to go to bring into the program. Others are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our first caller is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I got in on this one in terms of you were doing a great overview. Has there been studies that have been done of clinical psychologists in terms of, predictors of what makes a successful counselor? Has there been, I know there's been a lot of research done, but has there been ones to determine what are the factors that, in terms of being very successful in this field? Has there ever been anything done in that nature or not?
Yeah, I think that, and I certainly don't counter myself an expert in that literature, but yes, there's a very large literature on characteristics of effective clinicians. Obviously, training is an important part of that, and I think there's a fairly robust literature on the interpersonal relationship between the client and the counselor, if you will. And I think there's been quite a bit of focus on the goodness of that fit and the goodness of that relationship. And I certainly think that clinicians that like to work with folks and are effective at working with folks are very interpersonally oriented.
The other one, propaganda was certainly, but that wasn't so much in the clinical field, but during certainly the war, there was a great deal of research, wasn't it, done in terms of propaganda?
Yeah, I mean, psychologists were mobilized in all sorts of areas during the Second World War, and in fact, again, I come back to University of Illinois. I think some of the roots of the aviation psychology program could be found there at Illinois. Human factors, person-environment matching, as well as work on persuasion, propaganda, which was the Office of Strategic Services, which later became the CIA.
Yeah, and then finally, when you look at the various disciplines, even even to the point now in terms of history, but the influence of psychology in a lot of programs, the study of the behavioral aspects of it, which didn't exist or wasn't really studied to that degree. So I'll just stop at this point. Wonderful program.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Other questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked just before we talked with the caller about the importance of World War II and how that changed the profession. Just to take a step back, it seems to me there are two major points in the 20th century where there was a great deal of interest in psychology, enthusiasm for it, willingness to explore. And one of those times was the 60s, but the other time was the 20s. And that was a time of explosive sort of interest in psychology. What was going on in the 1920s that got so many people interested in psychology?
Yeah. I think it's an extension of what we were talking about the First World War. Psychologists were able to demonstrate that they did have some tools and some techniques that could aid the nation, and this certainly was true in the assessment classification of recruits. And that was largely, based on assessment of individual difference. It was based on testing. And there was, if you will, a kind of a testing craze in America in the 1920s. So we have a very large test collection here in the archives, probably some 12 or 14,000 tests. And just about anything that you could measure, whether that was scientifically measured or not, was measured. And it became the stuff that I think we still see today when you're standing in the checkout line, when you can, you know, check your emotional intelligence or, you know, rate your romantic IQ, you know, the kinds of things that we see. Mm-hmm. Very popular then as it is now. Self-help columns appeared in newspapers and were very popular. So there was, in the 20s, a real popularization of psychology.
Something that I think also is, I think, an interesting part of the story, and I'm sure that if you look at the history of psychology in America, there are a part of the story is our tensions and conflicts between different groups of individuals who have different priorities or perhaps different methods of practice, you know, who perhaps disagree on, you're trying to help somebody who's in emotional distress, they disagree over what's the best way to try to do that. Mm-hmm. And it seems that for a long time, and I don't know if it's quite as true today, but certainly for a long time, there was the tension. One of the main tensions was between people who were advocates of the sort of the classical talking cure, the kind of thing that we associate with Sigmund Freud, mm-hmm. The kind of thing which can be very intensive, can take a long time, and is based on the idea that you have to do, in a sense, deep mining mm-hmm. of the person's psyche
right.
to find out what are the underlying causes for the distress that the person is experiencing. One of the things I think is interesting about American psychology, though, is a sort of a strong pragmatic streak. I guess that's the way that I would describe it, mm-hmm. with a number of psychologists coming along and saying, look, we don't have to do that. You know, we don't have to take the time to dig back to find out what happened to you when you were 2 years old to deal with a case of emotional distress today. We just don't need to do that. You don't need to spend 20 years in therapy going several times a week. Let's just deal with the here and now. Let us deal. And it gets me again thinking about Albert Ellis. You know, mm-hmm, let's deal with the symptoms you're experiencing now. Let's take a look at the way in which you deal with the stresses of your daily life and see if we can teach you some better coping skills. And, you know, deal with the symptoms. And, you know, we just don't have to do the other thing. Am I right in thinking that that kind of pragmatic streak that argues for more short-term therapies, more let's deal with symptoms and let's not worry about deep causes, that also is something that is really distinctly American?
I would think so, and I think that these are some... I think there's kind of a confluence of two issues, and one is your basic philosophical position about human nature, whether you believe that you know, we are kind of these mechanistic systems that operate according to a set of laws, you know, laws that govern behavior, like laws that govern the physical universe. And there certainly are those that would say, yes, you know, you don't really even need to deal with the mind, you just need to deal with behavior, and that behavior is lawful, orderly, and predictable. And we look at the work of radical behaviorists who don't find that there's much need to refer to consciousness at all, that you just look at behavior. So that's a fundamental, that's a philosophical stance about about what you believe about human nature. Same thing philosophically, whether you believe that your life is determined by, say, in a Freudian system, which is very deterministic, that your personality is shaped by the time you're 5 or 6 years old, and you can't undo that. It's done. It's all kind of determined. Versus what you mentioned in the 60s, the humanistic movement, which really embraced free will. Those are philosophical positions that certainly will influence and guide someone's worldview and what they believe about themselves and what they believe about the capacity for change. Then, on the other hand, I think there's the more pragmatic issues, if you will, and that is, as you mentioned, David, psychoanalysis can take quite a bit of commitment of time and resources. It's expensive to go to therapy 3 to 5 times a week. And we live in an age where people are very busy and people want quick fixes for things. And so there's issues in the marketplace that also shape and impact the practice of psychotherapy. managed care, the introduction of managed care, the move towards empirically validated treatments that have impacted and influenced the field. And we certainly have reached a place now where many interventions are based in empirically validated. We have scientific evidence and support to say this is an effective treatment. And at the end of nearly 100 years, we've combined a lot of the best aspects of those other systems of psychoanalysis, of behaviorism, and developed models appropriate to those.
I think certainly within American psychology, there has been, and perhaps again, this would be the kind of thing that you would see often in university departments of psychology that had strong experimental bases, the idea that they're not going to talk to you about something like the subconscious, mm-hmm. because they're going to say, look, I cannot measure the subconscious. I can't hold it in my hand. I can't weigh
right.
it. I can't mm-hmm. do experiments on
sure.
it. So we're going to say, you know, maybe it is, maybe it's not. But since we can't operate on it experimentally, in a sense, we're just going to pretend like it doesn't exist. We're going to deal with the stuff that we can see, mm-hmm. which is where you get into, again, that, you know, people like B.F. Skinner, who said, look, I can measure inputs, I can measure outputs. What happens in the black box, I don't know. And so I'm not going to worry too much about that. Is that, how strong does that idea that there's that those things that we can't really hold in our hands, we're not going to even think about, is that still a problem, or perhaps as we get more and more to understand maybe working how the brain works, and we're actually getting more to understand how things work, that we're more willing to try to explore things that previously we said, well, there's no way I can do an experiment mm-hmm. on that, so I'm just not even going to think about that.
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a complicated one. I think that some of that kind of bifurcation between people and, you know, what different people would ascribe different names to it, bench science, hard science. I think there was a point in time where there probably was that kind of bifurcation between, you know, the people who saw this as a natural science and those who were much more interested in applications and practice. I think any psychology department today has an admixture of both, and I think everyone finds a way to peacefully coexist. But I think it's another point. You mentioned in talking about, you know, the emphasis now on brain science and all the really rapid advances in brain imaging and the technologies that go along with that. The field just continues to expand at a very rapid pace. And so I think it's that people are often, you find in a department, dealing with very kind of in-depth questions and programs of research that actually don't bring them into much contact with anybody else other than that small group of people that are very much focused on the one thing they're doing. Hmm. And I see that as a larger issue.
Just a little bit past our midpoint here, I just, for the benefit of anyone who just tuned in, want to introduce again our guest, David Baker. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Akron. That's in Akron, Ohio. He's also director of the Archives of the History of American Psychology, which is based there on the campus of the University of Akron. They, by the way, have a very nice website. If you're interested in finding out more about the archives, you can take a look at that. And questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. We have another caller here, someone here where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. Very interesting subject. I was in the advertising business for years, and basically marketing is basically all psychology. And I was curious as to what you were talking about earlier about the idea of therapy as and method versus now the modern pharmaceutical solutions to psychological or psychiatric problems. If you could discuss that, but I also wanted to add something else. P.J. O'Rourke just recently wrote a book about Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, something to the effect that he read the book and he edited it for you and told you this is the important part. And I had read it many years ago, and I was wondering, it struck me as when you would read his read his portions on, the dealings between the buyer and seller, that kind of thing. It seemed to me like it's an 18th century book. It seemed to me like if you were to pull it into the modern times, it would be just like an early primitive psychology manual. And I wonder if you had ever thought of that. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, so that last part, I certainly think in some ways there's not all that much that's new. I think human nature is human nature and has been so for quite a while. So I think there were plenty of people, and it's one of the it's almost one of the biases against the past, and applaud the reader for making those connections, that there's a great deal we can learn from the past. And I think people have been asking very fundamental questions about the nature of who we are and why we do what we do. And so certainly, obviously, I believe that that the historical record can offer us much in that regard. And also, I think there's a very interesting and wonderful history of psychology and advertising. Psychologists have been using psychological principles derived from the lab for all of the 20th century. In fact, we have a little small display up right now on early advertising. This is in about 1914, about an advertising campaign to select ads that would be that women would find most appropriate for buying a handgun. What would be most persuasive?
And when was that from?
This is like 1914.
You know, to go back to also on one of the other points that the caller made, and perhaps this not only says something about where we are, but perhaps where we're going. And I know that certainly you are interested in thinking about the future of the profession as well. And here, the thing that I'm thinking about is the increasing impact of managed care on the delivery of psychological services. And the concern seems to be that, first of all, there are a lot of people who don't have access to mental health care at all. And for those, a lot of people who do, if they're getting it in a managed care setting, the amount of care, there's a limit to how much care can be delivered. And that sort of goes hand in hand with the idea that perhaps we rely more than we should on medications, and that we're sort of getting away from the idea that yes, that one-on-one therapy can indeed be very beneficial, perhaps in conjunction with medication, but that whole, even the possibility of doing it is really being thrown into question by questions that simply have to do with the economics of healthcare delivery.
Yeah, and it's a large issue and a complicated issue, and I think that psychologists, I think, work very hard to certainly advocate for those treatments that are most efficacious for treating psychological problems. Depression's a great example. I think that the research would suggest strongly that a combination, where appropriate, of medication and talk therapy is the most effective intervention. But it's important, I think, too, for the public. Often there's a misunderstanding that psychologists are not physicians, and as such do not prescribe medication. So most often psychologists would work in conjunction with physicians, either family physicians or psychiatrists, if they had a client that they assessed to be in need of medication. Mm-hmm. Although I would tell you, David, that's changing, and psychologists are pursuing prescription authority. I believe, in fact, now in Louisiana and New Mexico, psychologists have prescription authority. And these are issues where we talk about not only access to services, particularly as an issue for folks in rural areas.
Well, that continues. I know that that's a controversial subject, and I suppose that also says that the kind of tensions within the field, particularly as psychology tried to organize itself, standardize practice, have some sort of control over who is practicing, this kind of tension that goes back a long time between psychologists who may indeed have advanced degrees and psychiatrists who are medical doctors who then go on to study psychiatry as a specialty. And of course, being doctors, they have prescription writing privileges, and really virtually nobody else does. Does one still see that kind of tension within the field between psychiatrists and psychologists?
It'd probably be a great show and to get some folks that are real authorities on the topic. But yeah, I certainly think there is, but I also think there's plenty of examples of and there's a very long history of psychologists working quite effectively in medicine and medical schools. Psychologists have had a presence in medical schools and VA hospitals for a very long time, and I think that one of the models that's emerging really is as practicing professional psychologists as healthcare professionals and working in primary care settings. And I think that is the, to me personally, is one of the better models where when you see your family physician, that there's a psychologist on staff as well, because we know quite clearly that many, many, many medical problems have a psychological component to them. And, in the principle that should guide all of us is that what's in the best interest of the patient.
Let us talk with someone else here. We have a caller, line number two. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I just wondered what impact, if any, did Alfred Adler's lectures have in the 30s? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. You want to talk about Adler?
Yeah, Adler was a disciple of Freud's, I would say that to answer the caller's question, that Adlerian psychology is much alive and well, and Adler's approach to the human condition is one that people continue to find very attractive.
Freud first visited the United States in 1909,
mm-hmm.
Amazingly enough, very early in the last century, and that was at a time, his first visit, this was at a time when he was not that well known in America, and I'm not even sure that much or any of his writing had even been translated into English, so that you would, if you wanted to read Freud, you would have had to read it in German.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a lot of people were interested in his work, and I'm sure that today there are still people who are doing traditional classical psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Freud and his ideas, you might say, whatever you want to say now about Freud and his ideas, one has to acknowledge that his thought, he was one of the most significant thinkers in the 20th century, probably at least in terms of how he influenced other people and how he got us thinking about things like human behavior. Having said all that, how important to American psychology was Freud?
I think you put your finger on it, David. It's huge, enormous, not only on American psychology, but certainly on American society and culture. A giant.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he did. He came in 1909 to visit Clark University at the invitation of G. Stanley Hall, one of the founder of the American Psychological Association, and you mentioned him at the top of your show. G. Stanley Hall was also the founder of the first American Journal of Psychology, the American Journal of Psychology,
mm-hmm.
which in fact has enjoyed a long run being centered at the University of Illinois.
Yeah. So I remember when I was an undergraduate, some faculty wag making this joke that they really wanted to name the psychology building after him so they could call it Hall Hall. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, well, that's a psychologist joke for you right there. Let's go on talk with someone over in Terre Haute in Indiana, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a sort of a self-ordained preacher, and I got a couple of questions. Does psychology teach or have anything to do with religion? And does psychology teach about anything psychic? I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
All right. Well, certainly there have been connections between psychology and religion. In fact, one of the early movements in American clinical psychology was, in fact, something that was started by a clergyman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. And again, it's one of those examples to me where history is so instructive and interesting and enjoyable. We claim William James, one of America's great philosophers, and we claim him as one of America's greatest psychologists. And William James was interested, the caller would want to reference some of that, really seminal work. William James wrote a very important book on the varieties of religious experience. William James believed that psychology should cast its net far and wide William James was very involved in psychical research. In fact, the president of the, I forget the psychical society or something, but devoted a good portion of his career to studying psychic phenomenon. So I think the spirit world is something that psychology, like many others, have had an interest in and have attempted to study it and to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Can you say something about connections between religion, religious practice, religious faith, and psychology? Has that been something that psychologists have wanted to keep at arm's length, or is that something that Sigmund Freud was interested in religion as a as a human behavior at least. To what extent does that get the religious values get incorporated, particularly in therapy? Or again, is that something that's considered to be, in a sense, a separate world, and a lot of psychologists just don't want to get in there?
Well, I think that's probably, there seems to be a popular perception that those are diametrically opposed. That someone's religious, spiritual beliefs is somehow antithetical to psychology or to psychotherapy. And obviously, I think that there's a perception out there, and if it's there, it exists for a reason, which I'm not particularly clear on, except maybe if you paint some very broad strokes, some separation of religion and science, or faith and reason, something like that. But I think you see today in many training programs, certainly an understanding, incorporation, and appreciation of people's religious and spiritual beliefs and how those impact their well-being, their physical well-being, their psychological well-being, and I certainly think that's an area that psychologists study with a great deal of interest and an open mind.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone in Champaign County, also here in a large sense here where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was trained in the humanistic psychology days. What's the current status of humanistic approaches to psychology? And sort of a second unrelated question, or perhaps related question, could you give a brief outline of forensic psychology? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Same thing. Both good. I'd be interested to hear more about the caller's experience with humanistic psychology. We'll deal with that first. But certainly, the humanistic movement that arose in the late 50s, early 60s, had a very large impact on American culture and society, and certainly a large impact on psychology and the practice of psychology. The idea of moving in a broad way, if you will, from matching persons to environments, this notion of adjustment that we talked about for a long part of the 20th century, to really more of a focus on the individual and on the satisfaction and the fulfillment of the individual. And I think that the humanistic movement was less deterministic, more concerned with free will. And I think that gave people permission for a lot of the openness and freedoms that we saw and the experimentation that we saw in the 60s. And I think that's all been incorporated into a focus in psychotherapy on personal self-growth, less focus on pathology, more on self-growth and fulfillment and things like that.
All right. We have just about 5 minutes left. I just want to remind people listening that we're getting close to the end of the time and that our guest is David Baker. He's professor of psychology at University of Akron. He's also director of the Archives of the History of American Psychology, based there at University of Akron. And as I mentioned once before, they have a really nice website, so you might want to go and check that out. And questions are welcome in the time that we have left. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, now we have obviously compressed a long and rich history into a very tiny space here, and we have just skated over the surface. If I said, name a couple of people, if you can pick out a couple of names who you would say in American clinical psychology in the 20th century, who would you say would be the most significant people? Is it possible to answer a question like that?
Yeah, I don't like questions.
I know. It's a really a very difficult and you know, maybe an unfair question.
Jeff. Well, it's an okay question. I would offer a name that that maybe a lot of people wouldn't be familiar with, but someone who really certainly deserves a place, and that's a psychologist by the name of David Shakow.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't have time to go into all the reasons for that, but David Shakow really was the person who kind of was the architect for the creation of clinical training programs to train professional psychologists. He did this work at mid-century, did some other very important work at the National Institute of Mental Health and Serious Mental Illness, really was, I think, a giant in the field.
Well, I'm glad we got around to mentioning him, because I must say that it's not a familiar name to me, and yet you in the book that you've co-authored that I mentioned at the beginning, you say that he's maybe one of the most influential clinical psychologists of the whole 20th century.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure that he's someone that outside of the field of psychology, people who have not studied this history or you know, not involved in it, this is not a name that you would. No, it's not up there with Ellison, Maslow, and Carl Rogers,
right.
And you know, and B.F. Skinner, and a lot of the other people that we have talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of those folks that I think you know, kind of have, again, and it's my plug for the historical record, David. I mean, I think that's one of the things that we seek to do here in the archives is mm-hmm. to find a place in history for those folks who toiled long and hard and made significant contributions, but didn't perhaps reach the public persona of some of the people that we know and are widely recognized.
Yeah. We'll try and get at least one more, if not two, callers. We'll go to Danville next, line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get back to the subject of psychologists prescribing drugs for mental illness. My daughter is a psychiatrist, and she has 4 years of college and then 8 years of medical training. And I think because so much of psychiatry deals with physical manifestations of phenomenon rather than social manifestations of phenomenon, and the medications that you use are biological in nature and cause biological side effects, I think that it is important that somebody with medical training is dispensing these drugs because of the side effects and because they are treating a biologically generated disease in many cases, like schizophrenia and some of the other bipolar things that show a strong family history of generation. And I think that's one of the big reasons why they feel very strongly that medical people should be dispensing these drugs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, she makes the argument very well. I'm sure that precisely is the argument that physicians make when it comes down to this matter. How do psychologists respond to those kind of arguments?
Well, I mean, certainly a good comment and an important one. And I think certainly, and again, I don't pretend to be a spokesperson on contemporary issues of prescription authority, but I would say that psychologists have a fair amount of training in the biological basis of behavior. It's one of the foundations of doctoral training in psychology. I certainly think that psychologists have a lot of training in brain behavior relationships, and the movement towards prescription authority, and it would be a great show, David, and you know, later I can give you some names of some folks that you might want to talk to.
Okay.
But certainly there is a focus on creating standards of training. Psychologists can't just go out and prescribe. I mean, there's certainly advanced training, supervised clinical experience that you would find in a medical school and in a medical school kind of model to ensure that psychologists have those competencies and that knowledge. But let me say, I think the issue is it's easy to become polarized and get into a turf issue. But if we keep the best interest of people with serious mental illness in mind, there simply are not enough people to treat people that have serious mental illness and have needs. I mean, that's where the focus needs to be.
Well, I want to thank the caller and apologize to one more we can't take because we're really at the end of the time. Just as a way of having some closure, as we say in the business, we talked earlier about the fact that the United States certainly has had made very important contributions, particularly to clinical and counseling psychology. If I asked you in one or two sentences to encapsulate that, to describe what America has given to the practice of psychology, can you come up with an answer?
Oh, well, I think, in a very broad way, I think that psychology in really all of its manifestations, both as a science, as a practice, as a means of social change, has really contributed to a greater understanding of ourselves and our relationship to others.
All right. Well, again, if you're interested in reading some on the subject of the history of psychology in America, you might look at a book that our guest has co-authored. The title is From Seance to Science, A History of the Profession of Psychology in America. Also, you might take a look at the website of the Archives of the History of American Psychology, based at the University of Akron, Ohio, where our guest David Baker is professor of psychology. Professor Baker, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, David.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 25th anniversary of offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana. Bodywork Associates now has an office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets, where this morning analytical firm Informa Economics forecast its 2007 estimate of U.S. corn production at 13.193 billion bushels with an average yield of 153.3 bushels to the acre. Informa suggests that soybean production is 2.628 billion bushels, reflecting an average yield of 41.8 bushels to the acre. Of course, USDA will release its updated crop production numbers on November 9th at 7:30 in the morning Central Time. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars in Kansas City. December wheat is now trading at 809, up 4.5. July at 683 is up 4.25. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 782, up 3.75. March, 804, up 3.25. July, 669.5, up 6.75. December corn, 378, now 378.25, up 9.25, now 9.5. March at 395, up 9. May, 404.75, up 9. December of next year at 424, up 7.25. November soybeans at 1001, up 10.25. January, 1017.5. Now 1017, up 10.5. March, 1032, up 10.25. November of next year at 965, up 5.5. December soybean meal, 274.20, up 210. December soybean oil, 42.50, up 43. At the Merck, December live cattle at 94.60, up 50. November feeders at 108.35, down 27.5. December lean hogs at 52.40, up 15, and February bellies at 84 even, up 2.30. Looking at Ed Kieser's two-state forecast today, he says, in northern and west central Illinois, mostly sun.